Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. I continue to invite some of my favorite, incomparable panelists and podcast hosts back on for a couple of reasons. One, I enjoy talking to them, and two, they're easy to get. I am joined today or tonight, whenever you're listening, by Mr. Joe Rosenstiel. Joe, thank you for coming back.
Thank you for telling me I'm easy.
Well, just in the sense that you are always eager to talk about Star Trek.
I am. You definitely identified that correctly. I 100% am here for Star Trek.
Before we start talking about Star Trek, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself?
I am a visual effects artist. I like Star Trek. In previous appearances on this podcast, I have described the fact that I started watching Star Trek with the Next Generation and the movies, and then into Deep Space Nine and Voyager, and unfortunately, a large amount of Enterprise, and then all of the recent stuff I've seen. So that's something new, because I think last time you and I talked, there wasn't much of the recent stuff, and now there's more of it. But we even had appearances on a couple of special panel episodes to recap seasons.
Yes,
about it.
Mm-hmm. We are living in a golden age of Star Trek, certainly with quantity, if not quality. Although I think the quality is good, but there are some folks who disagree, and that's their right, but they're wrong. Joe, tell me, since we are living in a golden age of Star Trek, if some fancy big shot, I guess they're Paramount Plus now, is that what they're called? CBS All Access? I don't know. Whatever. The people who are now producing all the Star Trek shows said, hey, Joe, we are out of ideas for Star Trek, and we need you to come up with a 13-episode show. You can do whatever you want. Where would you set it, and what would it be about? And I will talk a little bit, because listeners, here's a little peek behind the curtain. I never tell the people who are coming on the podcast what this first question will be, so Joe has no preparation. So unless he had something in his mind already, which he's a Star Trek fan, maybe he did, I thought I'd a vamp, as they say in the biz, to let him think of an answer.
Well, I was trying to think while you were talking. I used to have an answer for this, which was to basically do what Star Trek Picard did, only slightly different, but that same sort of time period, picking up more or less where we left off with the Next Generation era of things, to follow on with the most recent timeline as it existed then, before Discovery jumped 900 years into the future of that. You know, now that both of those things exist, I think my answer might be that I would want to have a series that's more like Deep Space Nine, not necessarily a continuation of Deep Space Nine, but maybe sort of dealing with a long-running, mostly kind of, I guess, stationary grouping of things. And so I would offer up a the task of rebuilding the connections that people have in the Gamma Quadrant, and the stuff after the Dominion War, and the perils of dealing with that, of managing this power vacuum that has occurred, because the Dominion is no longer there. And you can have Kira Nerys running the show, and it's all about her trying to oversee this stuff, and she's complaining all the time that she's not cut up for this sort of thing, and that she wishes that Sisko were there to do it. I don't know, but what I just would like to see something where it's kind of stationary and about those sorts of politics, because I know we're going to have a series that's going to be about exploring strange new worlds again, and I know we're going to have a series that's going to be about Picard sort of righting the wrongs in his own personal life, and we're going to have a series that's very far in the future, doing far future things. So I think this would be a complement to those existing properties.
We're here to talk about an episode of The Next Generation, a particular episode of The Next Generation from Season 5, Episode 9, A Matter of Time. This is a time travel episode, Joe.
Yes. Although, technically, it's not time travel in the way that we might think of it. So it's interesting in that regard. It mercifully, it doesn't involve any crew doing any shenanigans, but it has someone doing shenanigans
that
makes it interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a kind of a twist on the normal time travel story, because the crew are the time travelees, not the time travelers, I suppose. So they're being visited by a time traveler who is there to, well, he says he's there to observe this historical moment, but it turns out that he's really there to steal a bunch of trinkets and go back to the past where he came from and sell them? Invent them? I don't know. Seems like a bad plan to me, Joe, because I was thinking about this. He says, I think somewhere in the episode, that he is from, what, 200 years in the past, something like that? This is the...
Yeah, I think so. I think he said the 22nd century, and they're in the 24th century, and the vessel that he's in and claims to be from is the 26th century.
Yes.
They just like the round numbers for some reason.
Because it's easy. And that led me to think, well, so we are in 2021 as we record this. And so if someone from 200 years ago, that would be 1821, came to 2021 and stole some stuff, like I'm looking at, you know, I have a nice point-and-shoot camera on my desk, for example, that perhaps would be something that a time traveler would steal and go back in time to invent. But there's no infrastructure to support the invention of this camera, so it would have no value to anyone in 1821.
Yeah, not a lot of chip fabs back then. No. But I feel like he probably would stand a better chance of making larger versions of the items, maybe. He may not be able to scale down things as much as they are, but he would have some sort of a chance at manufacturing something on a larger scale. But I agree that there's certain stuff where it's just like, I'm not sure you're gonna really nail that one, like the visor, where it's like, well, doesn't that have like really particular like software that has to interface with someone's brain? Like, how are you? Did you take any of that stuff? Like, what was your plan? What's your plan for doing that? Right now you just have something that makes fancy images that you can't actually see because it's supposed to be beamed into somebody's brain.
Yes, he did not think this through. Although I guess, you know, part of it, you can explain that away with, you know, he is taking what he can because he is where he is. You have a sense that, and I guess we should just jump into the episode, but you have a sense that he found this time machine, time ship, whatever they call it, time pod, I think maybe is that what they call it? I don't know, it doesn't matter. And he doesn't really know how to use it, like he had to figure it out himself. So one assumes he's just happy that a ship came by and he can steal stuff from them. As opposed, you know, he wasn't planning, because he obviously never heard of the Enterprise, he wasn't planning to go to the Enterprise and steal stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting things about his con man routine, is because he keeps claiming to know. He has a certain certainty about things, and then when you realize that he really doesn't actually know anything about what's happening, and he has no clue how anything's going to unfold, that he's really sort of clueless and fumbling through the entire thing, and it's all just a confidence game. Like he's just putting on this front for everybody else, so that they think that he knows what he's doing, and they think that he has knowledge that he's not sharing, when in fact he has nothing, and he's just bluffing the entire time.
It's true. He does have possibly the best name for a guest character ever, Berlinghoff Rasmussen, as played by Matt Frewer, TV's Max Headroom. For those in the know, that evil guy from Orphan Black, whose name I cannot remember, the character's name. It doesn't matter. Dr. Leakey. There you go.
Yeah.
For you.
And I mean, he's a famous character actor for many things, so it's always fun to see him. But what I found interesting was I remember from a long time ago that Robin Williams was supposed to be a guest star on The Next Generation. I didn't realize that this was the role that was supposed to be written for Robin Williams, was the one that they gave to Matt Frewer when Robin Williams backed out of doing this, supposedly because his wife was 8.5 months pregnant when they were going to shoot it, and he had just done Hook, and he was tired. I am really glad that it's Frewer and not Robin Williams, I guess. Not that Robin Williams would have been bad, but I think that Matt Frewer has a ability to be very oily, and conniving. I don't know. He comes off a certain way. He can come off a certain way. He's an actor. He has range. But he can manage to do this sort of con man routine very well. And I appreciate seeing him do it.
Yes, it would be a very different episode if Robin Williams were playing this character. I imagine, I mean, Robin Williams was known as a great improviser, so I imagine it would be significantly different if Robin Williams were in here. Of course, Robin Williams could also read what he was told to read and be a fine actor, but I think that they would have wanted him to you know, yuck it up. I'm sure that would have been a direction. Yuck it up, Robin.
Yeah, well, would want to know what impersonations he would be doing, because he always tended to sort of skew that way for these sorts of things at this time period. Anyways, this was before his serious movies.
And they would ask him to do impersonations of people that they would know, and he wouldn't know them. So how would he do it?
Yeah, maybe he'd make up an impersonation that he would claim to be from the 26th century, and that they just don't get it yet.
He'd say, this is really good. Give it 200 years and you'll appreciate this. So yeah, there are two plots, basically, in this episode, which is, you know, very traditional Star Trek format. There is the poor planet who is suffering from asteroid collision that has caused a ecological disaster, and the Enterprise is there to basically shoot at the planet until the problem is solved. That's a little more complicated than that, but that's generally what they do. And then we've got our time traveling con man who appears and says, basically, hey, I'm here to watch, don't bother, you know, just ignore me, go about your normal business. I'm not here because this is of particular note. And then, of course, everyone's like, well, you obviously are here because something is going to happen. So tell us what happens. And he's like, no, I can't. I must say that Captain Picard seems very trusting of this person's story. There is a scene where basically everyone's like, I don't know about this guy. And Captain Picard is like, well, he's got this fancy ship. And he uses the line, I've checked his credentials.
Yeah, I thought that was weird too. I was just like, what credentials? Did he have like an ID card? Like time traveling ID card?
I was like, I don't understand. What credentials did he, I don't know. Like, even if you could just ask him some basic history questions, he could not answer them. So it seems strange. But everyone's like, no, he's fine. And I appreciate that he, as a character, basically just compliments everybody and makes them feel like they're super important, and that they are, you know, history remembers the Enterprise. And he talks about how, you know, there's great debate over Picard's ready room and where the book was in his ready room, to which Picard is like, I don't think people care where the book was in my ready room 200 years from now. But I just thought that was a nice touch, where he's basically saying, you know, you guys are super important. I'm here. I don't want to distract you. But, you know, go about your life, and also fill out this very long questionnaire.
Yeah. One thing though that I thought was interesting was his interactions with Deanna. Counselor Troy, she is usually better at picking up on baloney than this, but she does identify baloney emanating from his direction, and you know, kind of shuts him down and says that she doesn't like him and that sick bay scene specifically. Unfortunately, I felt like they didn't do enough with that, because I would have liked to have seen her wariness and her doubts confirmed and sort of like publicly put out there. But in the end, it winds up being basically all of the other crew who's the main cast saying that, and they're all the ones who were conned. So it would have been nice to see her have her moment to say, see, I told you so, about him.
Yeah, she basically says he's hiding something, and they're all like, of course he's hiding something, he doesn't want to tell us what happens in the future, gosh, Deanna. And she's like, no, I think he's hiding more than that, but whatever, do what you want, be flattered by this weirdo. And we later find out he's from New Jersey. So don't trust anyone who's from New Jersey, is what I'm saying. And he is, I mean, this episode is pretty straightforward. So Geordi goes down. So the big thing is, oh no, this planet is in trouble, and so let's shoot some phasers at the planet's surface to unleash some pockets of CO2. Right, that will sort of warm up the planet because it's currently falling into what they liken to a nuclear winter from Earth's 20th century.
21st century,
that's right.
Yeah. We still have that to look forward to after the pandemic.
But apparently, you know, you just shoot the ground and out comes CO2 and it'll be fine for a little bit until volcanoes happen. So they attempt that first and then it doesn't work out well. And so they need to try a different thing because they're ratcheting up the stakes here, right? And so thousands of people could die the first time around. And then they realize that if they do something with the deflectors, I didn't really pay attention to the technobabble in this episode, but basically they do something with the deflectors and shoot the planet and then it bounces off into space or something. If it works, if it doesn't work, it burns off the atmosphere and kills everybody on the planet.
It's a pretty risky maneuver, especially since they bungled the other thing that was supposed to be like super easy. So I don't know why, but everybody on the planet approved the plan. So Picard's like, yeah, well, we gotta take the risk and do it. And it's just like, do you?
Yeah.
I mean, it could be real bad if you misjudge this. And he even makes that argument to Berlingoff, where he is telling him, like, you have to tell, he has a pretty good scene with yes. him and Berlingoff. We're going back and forth where it's mainly Picard badgering Berlingoff to try and like break him into telling him something one way or the other about whether or not he's going to wind up killing all these people. I you know, because Berlingoff doesn't actually know, he actually feels a little bad and doesn't want to say one way or the other because he doesn't want to kill these people. Mm-hmm. He'd much rather have Picard do that, but that's not the point of the scene. The point of the scene is Picard trying to argue about how they could change the outcome of something for the better. And you listen to something like that, and then at the end he's just like, yep, we're gonna take the risk and we're gonna blow up the atmosphere, maybe, sort of, but it'll be fine. We're gonna use the deflectors, ionizing the whole thing, plasma, let's go,
it'll be good,
the lightning rod.
Yeah. And I thought to myself, so Picard is like, oh, this is my choice, and you know, you can't, I'm not asking you to tell me what will happen, just to give me a glimpse into what I maybe should do, because he's trying to skirt around this whole, you know, because he does, Berlinghoff makes a good point, even though he doesn't know, that basically says, you know, I'm from the future, I can't tell you what happens, because then my future may not turn out, because if I tell you something, then it may change what you were going to do, and then I may never exist, right? So he makes a strong argument, even though, of course, we know that he's not from the future, so he really just doesn't know, so he can't tell Picard anything. And Picard's like, well, it's my decision, and I always like to take risks or something like that. And I thought, is it really your decision? Because there are like millions of people on the planet that perhaps should be consulted. And then there's a scene right after that where basically the, I guess, chief scientist, or it's unclear what this doctor who's in a bunker with Geordi is, but he basically gives the okay. So I guess he speaks for the planet.
Well, they had some lines in there about how they were running it past, I think it was like a council or something. And it's like, if you have millions and millions of people, I don't know if everybody's really on board. Even if you've got like a council of like 10 people who are supervising this, who knows? Who knows what's happening? It doesn't really seem like a direct democracy kind of a situation. But they supposedly are on board for the purpose of this plot moving forwards and to do this thing that we all kind of, we know how it's going to pan out, essentially, because they're not going to kill everyone on the planet with a fireball and then Geordi along with it. It'd be a very different series.
It's true. He is that, and that's a good point. Geordi is on the planet. So even watching this the first time around, you would know, well, Geordi's on the planet. They're not going to kill Geordi, so everyone's going to be fine. But
I do like that call that they make down to him where they're like, Geordi, we're gonna have you beam up. And he's like, no, I'm gonna stay down here. And he's like, are you sure? You could die. And it's like, you're saying that right in front of the scientist guy.
There's a good chance everyone on the planet's gonna die. You should really beam up.
Yeah, we're just gonna save Geordi. The rest of you, forget about it. You have weird uniforms. We don't want to save you.
You did this to yourselves. And they think, what? An asteroid hit the planet. We didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. You probably did something to deserve that.
I mean, it's a nice change of pace from the usual, like, we have to deliver this antidote or vaccine to whatever Alpha 5-7, and then that's, you know, the thing that sort of is the countdown timer on the episode. And in this one, it's a little bit more interesting, I would say, especially with, oh yeah, we're just gonna do this thing, and it made it worse, and then we're gonna do this other thing, and it could destroy everyone. But yes. It's engaging.
I do always like the Star Trek episodes that feature kind of the two-part solution, where the first part they make it worse, and then the second part they're like, yeesh, we really need to fix this now, even more than it was before. I just enjoy that, because, you know, generally our friends from Star Trek are competent and know what to do, and they show up and they solve the problem. So I like it when they show up, are very confident that they're going to solve the problem, and then screw it up royally.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to know exactly how the thing you've never done before is going to go. That's true. So, yeah, I can give them some credit on that one. But at the same time, I thought it was interesting how trusting Dr. Moseley and the rest of the people on the planet were about the Enterprise doing this after they messed up the drilling thing. There was like no hesitation in going forward to this plan to potentially kill everyone. Yeah.
Well, what do you expect them to do? Leave their planet? There's a little video going around of a parody of Star Trek where basically the Captain Picard character talks to people on a planet, and the people on the planet say, "We refuse to leave our planet, even though our planet is going to be destroyed." And then 2 seconds later, they're like, "We are leaving our planet because," or Picard says, "Your planet's going to be destroyed," and they say, "Oh, you completely convinced us to leave our planet." And so it's kind of a trope that they're not going to leave. Although it's only the Enterprise there, so they can't carry away millions of people. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh no, there was, and it's one of those unfortunate things where it's the budget of the series, where you're going to see a control room that has five people in it and props that have been rented and used over and over and over again, mm-hmm. and that's your planet of millions of people. That's on the line, and there's a map painting with some snow, so yes. You know, it's doing a lot of work there.
And unless, dear listeners, you have not watched this episode and you fear for the millions of people that are on Penthara 4, don't worry, they're all fine at the end. They shoot the stuff away and everything turns green and it's great, and everyone lives happily ever after. We will never speak of this planet again. Although I guess I should actually. Apparently, it makes an appearance in some Chief O'Brien centric novel later. Not the planet so much as this character, but I don't think it's ever mentioned in any other show. Feel free to write in if it is, but I don't think it is. But they're all fine.
Do Lower Decks on Penthara 4 and the long term effects of having their atmosphere blown away. Because they do ionize the atmosphere to get rid of these particles and whatever the ash that's in the upper layer and all this other stuff. It's not gonna have a zero effect on the rest of the atmosphere composition. But whatever, everybody's happy at the end. It's clear skies.
That's right. They're all fine, and that's what the Enterprise has to leave before there are any long, you know, any other impact is discovered. So you know, other ships from Starfleet apparently arrive to clean up those messes. And I want to talk about now is now right now. There is so Rasmussen. I'm saying Rasputin, and his name, Berlinghoff, is very charming to everybody on the ship, with one exception. He's kind of a jerk to Data for some reason. Did you pick up on this, or was I'm just reading in to this because I like Data so much?
No, you're right. I think the thing is that he would be nicer to He's initially nicer to Data, I think. I think he sort of is puzzled by his interactions with Data, especially like when he walks into the room and he's listening to all the music all simultaneously, and he's sort of annoyed and doesn't really understand how that's possible or what it could mean. But he's not particularly nice to him. Not exactly in the same way as, like, I think Dr. Pulaski was meaner to Data than Rasmussen. Rasmussen is, but he's not kind to him. I think that he realizes that his shtick is where it doesn't really accomplish anything when he's talking to Data, that he doesn't really pick up on the stuff, and he doesn't really have anything to work with, like bouncing back from Data, because Data's just blank.
Yes, Data is not as beguiled or flattered by his attention. He's just like, oh, I'll help. The captain has told me to help you. I'll help you. The thing that made me think, I don't like this guy, is when Data brings him to his quarters, because Captain Picard immediately offers to let him stay on the ship, even though he's a random person who they've just found. And he basically looks around and treats Data almost as if, but I don't treat these people this way either, like bellhops or something. And he goes in and like washes his hands and then makes Data give him a towel. And I thought, that's not very nice. Get your own towel, man.
No, and it's not even, it doesn't seem like it would absorb any water at all. but I don't understand the sinks, because it's always like there's just a basin, a wash basin, and it's like, but I want running water. I don't want to just like take my dirty hands and then just put them in a, swish them around in the same body of water. Doesn't seem like it's accomplishing much, but the part he's holding out his arms like a T-Rex, like waiting for Data to just give him the towel. He doesn't even ask for one. And I could understand like being not knowing where the towel would be and just being like, oh, could you tell me where the towel is? But they played this way on purpose.
Yes.
That he's a jerk.
And he knew, so when you walk into that room and you are not familiar with the Enterprise, I would think that most people, 99% of the people, would not know where a sink is in that room, because you have to press a button and it unveils itself, and it's not even a sink. It's just, as you said, just like a vat of stagnant water that's hidden under a retractable like desktop thing. But he knows where to go and press the button. I'm like, how do you know where that sink is, mister?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, one thing they didn't get into in this episode at all is what information was available on the time pod to him.
Oh, that's true.
That he could read, because maybe he read up a little on some things about the time period that he was going to, but I don't know what he would have read, and he doesn't reveal anything about whether or not he did read anything. He certainly doesn't seem to have a full grasp of any of the in any situation that he's in, and even like the transporter thing, the intro to the episode, the cold open where he beams over, he has to ask Picard to move, presumably because he doesn't know how to change the coordinates for the transporter, what it's going to do, I guess.
One assumes.
It's obviously just written that way for it to be funny.
It's funny.
It's the kind of thing where he doesn't seem to have a full working knowledge of things, but he does seem to have some knowledge of some things. So I don't know how much of that is stuff he read and how much of that is stuff he's just sort of bluffing his way through. Like maybe he was going to walk over there and, you know, cause there was a mirror, maybe he's going to walk over there and see if there was a sink and there's a button and he pushes it and it just happened to be a sink. Maybe if it didn't actually turn into a sink, maybe he would have not done that. I don't know.
Roll with it. Cause he's a con, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess so.
But, maybe he still holds out his hands in order to get the shiny space towel, though.
I do find the textiles that they use in The Next Generation to denote that they're in the future space sheets and towels to be hilarious. Just because none of them look particularly practical or comfortable to sleep in or rub against your body to absorb water. But that's neither here nor there. I may watch too much Star Trek, Joe, because I have these these opinions. But you do make a good point, because I don't recall, so I've seen this episode several times before, but I wasn't thinking to pay attention at the beginning to see if he knew their names before he came. Like when he appeared, did he know who they were? Or was he just kind of picking up on their names as they were introducing themselves? I wasn't really paying attention, so I don't know. Because that could be a clue that he did a little research before he showed up. But
yeah, I mean, he says everybody remembers the old 1701D when he shows up. But you could read that on the outside of the ship.
Written on the ship, so that's kind of like a thing that you would say.
Yeah, but who knows if he typed that in and got the list from the time pod of who was actually running things. I'm not sure. Right. But
because they pass him by, like he appears, and this is a very Captain Picard thing. Like they're off to go to this planet that, you know, is suffering a horrible ecological catastrophe. And then there's this unexplained temporal phenomenon. And he's like, does it make a big deal if we're an hour late? And everyone's like, nah, not really. And they're like, okay, well, let's check out this temporal anomaly then. I just thought that was funny.
Yeah. And I also like Worf is sort of reluctantly telling him, because I don't think Worf wants to deal with what the temporal like, anomaly is.
This is going to be some dumb thing.
Temporal anomalies.
He's probably going to steal my knife for no apparent reason.
Yeah, he wants the technology from that knife.
That was, I was perplexed by that, the inclusion of, other than, you know, it's an alien thing, of that in his pilfering. It seems like, you know, sure, it's like a fancy switchblade, basically, but I think in the 22nd century, you could even come up with that without having to steal it from the 24th century.
Maybe it's an exotic alloy or something.
Oh,
I don't know.
There you go. Yeah. Giving them the benefit of the doubt, Joe. Good for you.
I mean, I certainly could not believe that they just would take a tray of random props that they happen to have on the show and put them there on the set. That definitely doesn't seem like something they would do.
No. And I wonder if it's a thing where when this was first broadcast, you wouldn't really see, I mean, you would see the knife, I suppose, but you wouldn't see it as clearly as we now see it watching, you know, whatever, 25 years later or however long it is. 30 years later, good Lord.
Yeah, it is almost 30, because I think this was filmed September 1991, and then wow.
Goodness, now I'm depressed, Joe.
With the Next Generation, I think they had a lot of benefit of the doubt that nobody was really going to pause and sort of rewind and look at things. And they certainly didn't have it in HD. People would be dazzled by the holographic, shiny interior and blinking lights of the time pod. Yeah,
that time pod seems not so comfortable, but I guess maybe you don't spend too much time in your time pod, or time is, you know, your servant, so you can spend as little or as much time in your time pod as you want, because it's very small. It doesn't feel like you can sleep in, well, I suppose you could, but it doesn't look like there's any quarters in there.
No, but it does like materialize a door, so maybe it materializes a bed. Who knows? Yes.
I did like that materializing the door thing. And I liked the, so basically at the end of the episode, he is not as clever as the crew of the Enterprise, and everyone has, as Joe previously mentioned, rejected Deanna's troubles with him, but they have found that he's been stealing things. And so they confront him outside of his time pod, and he basically is like, I really, you know, I can't let you in because there's, you know, secret time things in there and it will screw up your future. And Picard says, well, we'll send Data in because he is apparently the only crew member who is trustworthy. which I found kind of odd. I mean, I understand where they're coming from, because Data is, you know, an artificial being, so he can be, I guess, programmed not to reveal the secrets, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's more, it's more about, I think his argument is, like you said, it's more about the artificial nature, where he can programmatically remove that memory, yes, which we've seen Data do in other instances.
And I think at this point, Picard and everybody knows that this guy is not who he says he is, so they don't really, I think Picard's just kind of humoring him and say, well, we'll send Data in, you can trust Data. And so Data goes in to check out what's in there, and he finds all of the things that he has stolen. And there's a very exciting scene, or not so exciting, but he's going to try and kill Data, but turns out the computer deactivated the phaser that he stole, so he doesn't kill Data. Big shock. And now I kind of think, now, Joe, you have to tell me your opinion of this ending, because it strikes me as slightly cruel to our poor con man, because he has programmed his time pod to leave at, like, you know, 9 a.m. or whatever. It doesn't really matter what time. And I think he tells everybody that, like, he has to be on there because it is leaving. And Captain Picard does not let him go on. and it disappears. And now he is stranded in the 24th century, and Captain Picard, kind of a little callously, I feel like, says something like, you know, welcome to the 24th century or something like that. And now this man, like everyone he has known, like, now he was going to steal some things, but really is the punishment for, you know, misrepresenting yourself and stealing some trinkets that you should be ripped from everyone you have ever known or loved and stranded in the future?
I mean, there are worse punishments, but I have to say that this is definitely, like you said, cruel. But at the same time, given what they had to work with, you don't really want to let him go back in time.
Well, that's true.
With the time pod. So that he's there is a problem, but I feel like they should have used some different dialogue to wrap this up that would have made it seem less like a punishment that he was in the future. It also sort of flies in the face of the conversation that I complimented earlier between Berlinghoff Rasmussen and Picard, where there's this back and forth about what the ethics are of doing something that would change the past. Removing someone from the past mm-hmm. does change the past too. So mm-hmm. you would not want to ideally do that, I guess, unless he was always removed from the past.
Well, that's where it gets tricky.
Yeah.
Because maybe
should just have the dialogue where it's just like, we're going to have Starfleet Temporal Investigations deal with you, and they'll figure out what to do about sending you home or something.
Right. I feel like you could send him home.
Yeah, you just slingshot him around the sun. And he'll be
put
fine.
Put him in a photon torpedo, slingshot him around the sun. It'll be fine. He'll end up back in New Jersey in the right time, I think.
I mean, time travel happens so much in Star Trek that he's sort of like waiting for the right bus or a plane or something at this point, because everybody's time traveling all the time.
That's true. You stay in the same place for long enough and you're going to time travel back to where you want to be. So it's fine. I assume that he goes back to New Jersey and has quite a story to tell his friends. But at the end of the episode, we are led to believe that he goes to Starbase 214 and spends the rest of his life locked up in the brig being grilled by Starfleet historians about 200 years ago.
Yeah. I wonder if they were asking where the book was in his office. But there's something weird, though, that would maybe make this seem less cruel, is that Berlinghoff Rasmussen, when he's talking to Data in the pod, when he thinks he's got, you know, he thinks he has leverage on Data because he has the phaser. He reveals that the gentleman who owned the time pod was from the 26th century, and he had the unfortunate, I think he said something like the unfortunate circumstance or something of running into Berlinghoff Rasmussen. And they don't really resolve whether or not Rasmussen killed him for the time pod or if something else befell this person and he just didn't help what, but that person does not have a time pod anymore.
That's true. That person is either dead or stuck in a time as well, like stuck out of time, out of his time. So I suppose you've swayed me. He got what he deserves.
No, I'm not saying that. I could have, as the captain of the ship, he should have been more diplomatic about that, is one way of looking at it. To make it seem less, like, petty, I guess.
Yeah, but Rasmussen is the particular kind of character that really annoys Captain Picard. And so I feel like he was just, he's a kind of a Q-esque, not quite as bad as Q, but he is Q-esque and, you get a feeling that he just grates on Captain Picard, especially since Captain Picard is, you know, himself an amateur historian and archaeologist. He's probably deeply offended that this guy's pretending to be a historian.
Yeah, and like you said, he's Q-like in that he pretends to have this omnipotent, you know, knowledge of what's going to happen and how things will unfold, like much in the way that Q would taunt Picard whenever he shows up, that, oh, you're going to do that or whatever. And there's that to hang over it, even though he doesn't have any powers to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Which makes it even worse.
Yeah. Which makes it actually more dangerous.
Yeah. It does make it more dangerous. That's true.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting, though, just in terms of a just the pacing and the production of this episode, how long they take to tease out that Rasmussen is up to no good. And I couldn't figure out if it's just maybe that I've seen this before, but it's sort of like you spend the whole episode and you're just like, come on guys, figure this out. This is taking it so long.
Yeah. And I think, I feel like it, even the episode itself, obviously we've both seen this a number of times. And so, but I was surprised at how long it took the episode to get around to showing us him like palming a pad. Like, it doesn't happen as quickly as I remembered in my head. The episode kind of wants to, even though you know there's something wrong with this guy, he's not quite on the level, but it does take a while for him to basically do the thing that you're expecting him to do.
Yeah, like they, TNG always had like these big musical swells right at the commercial breaks, to also sort of like give you sort of, I guess, like a mini cliffhanger of, oh, what's going to happen after we come back from commercial. And the first one of those that's supposed to like tease out something, it's up to something, I guess, is when he eats that apple that he took off the table in his quarters, and you're just, and there's a big music swell for that, and you're just like, I don't know if eating the apple means he's untrustworthy.
I think that apple was there for him to eat.
Like, that's not the one. Like, if he ate the stolen pad, that would have been weird. tipped us off.
Yeah. So, wait a second. What is he doing? Maybe that's what they do in the future.
Yeah.
They love pads. Eating 24th century pads. They're delicious.
He's gone back in time to steal a delicacy that's no longer in the future.
So, Joe, on the whole, though, what did you think of this episode?
I mean, I like it. I find it entertaining. It's not my favorite episode of Star Trek, but I...
What?
I am engaged with what's happening, and I like Matt Furrer in this role. I like his interaction with Picard and... his smarminess with everyone, and I like the broad notion of what's happening, and the B story doesn't suffer as badly as a lot of TNG B stories can suffer when they're like trying to fix a planet. So I give it kudos for that, for being better and also seemingly integrated with the dynamic of what's happening, where pressure is being placed on Rasmussen because of the B plot. So I thought that was good. They're not like completely unrelated. So I overall like this episode. Does it stand the test of time as being something that I want to like put out there as something that should be an introduction to Star Trek for someone or something? But I'm not sure about that one. But I still appreciate it 30 years later.
And it's a season 5 episode. There are some really good episodes in season 5. I don't know if it's in the top 5 episodes of season 5, but it is a good entertaining episode. And it came after Unification 1 and 2, so it's kind of a nice, you know, break from the heaviness of those two, that two-parter, to give us a light episode about a planet nearly dying and a guy getting stuck in time.
Just a real easy breezy one, but it is interesting that I was reading Memory Alpha before this, and even the producers were like, "Yeah, we need something light after that." That's two-parter Spock episode. And it's like I guess it's just interesting to think that that's how you would do TV back then. You would just be like, "Well, we just have this completely separate and disconnected thing, and we're going to do it after this other thing as sort of like a palate cleanser, I guess, and then we'll do some other thing the next week, and it'll just be totally unrelated." Whereas you would not do that with modern Star Trek, or even, I mean, they would still do it on Deep Space Nine from time to time, like that baseball game episode, and it's just like, yes, okay, you guys are having fun, but it has nothing to do with anything else that's happening in the series.
This is the 7th season, come on. Yeah, TV has changed so much. I don't need to tell you that, but it is interesting. These episodes are like little time capsules. Oh, see what I did there? Of the past, and it's interesting to see both how they fit in and survive the rigors, or not so well, the rigors, the test of time, and to get a glimpse at the way television used to be and how television very, very rarely is now. I'm sure there are shows that are like this, I guess, where they're just kind of series of episodic things that happen that aren't particularly related to one another. Maybe sitcoms are probably the best example, even though I think now, even now, sitcoms are doing arcs. So who knows? But I do know one thing, Joe, and that it was a pleasure to talk to you about Star Trek, and I enjoyed our time together.
It's always a pleasure talking to you, Scott, and thank you very much for having me on again.